Right. So, you know how sometimes, like in a trial, you have this whole question of can you use someone's past? Can you use their past to say, well, they did this before, so they must have done it again?
Oh yeah, that's one of those fundamental tensions you run into in evidence law all the time.
Right.
In this case, United States v. Beasley really brings that to the forefront.
It does, especially when you're talking about trying to prove what someone was thinking, their intent.
Yeah,
Like you
exactly.
can't, crawl inside their brain. So how do you
Yeah.
prove that?
Yeah.
And this case is, it's like it's almost required reading if you're trying to wrap your head around these two big rules in evidence law.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Rules 404B and 403.
Yeah.
For anyone out there who is, trying to become a lawyer, especially dealing with trials.
Yeah, this is a must-know case.
Yeah. And it really, the core of it is this issue of the prosecution wants to prove the defendant had a certain state of mind when
That's
they were
what you
doing
get.
something, right? When they committed a crime. And so naturally they look to, well, what have they done in the past?
Right.
What are the clues we can find? But the problem is, and this is what Beasley's all about, is you don't want to just say, well, this person's just a bad person.
Right.
They've done bad things before, so they must be guilty now. It's much more specific than that. You have to say, no, their past actions directly inform why we think they had this intent in this particular case.
Yeah. And I think for all of you out there, especially if you're in law school right now, this isn't just some theoretical thing.
Oh,
This
no.
has huge implications for, what a jury sees, what a jury hears.
Absolutely. This is the stuff that, determines what evidence gets in, what arguments you can make, and it can absolutely swing the entire outcome of a trial.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
So whether you end up as a prosecutor and you're trying to use this evidence, this past stuff, or you're on the defense and you're
Yeah.
trying to keep it out,
Yes.
knowing how this all works is crucial.
It is. It is. So, we're talking about Beasley. Let's talk about the man himself. Who was he?
Yeah, who is this guy?
So this wasn't just some random person. Beasley, he had a PhD in chemistry.
Oh, wow.
He was working as a consultant for this company called Meese Inc. And that's important to kind of keep in mind. That'll come back later when we talk about the defense that he used.
Right, so we've got like a, someone with a scientific background. So what exactly were the charges against him?
So he was indicted on 9 counts. Okay, so this wasn't just one little charge.
Wow.
7 of those counts were for what's called intent to distribute Delodid.
Okay.
Now, Delodid, for those of you who don't know, it's a controlled substance. It's an opioid.
Okay.
So they're saying he was obtaining Delodid with the intent to sell it, to distribute it, not just having it for himself.
Right.
Okay. The other 2 counts were for how he got those drugs. So it was all about fraudulent procurement, basically lying to get the prescriptions for those drugs.
Okay, so not just the drugs themselves, but how he got them in the first place. So how did he do that? I mean, how do you go about getting all these prescriptions if they're controlled substances?
Right. Well, here's where the story gets interesting.
Okay.
Because remember, Beasley has the scientific background.
Right.
So what the prosecution said is that he went to doctors and he said, I need these drugs. I need Delodid for experiments I'm doing. I'm doing experiments on plants. And based on that, he was able to convince a doctor to write multiple prescriptions.
Okay.
But here's the thing. These prescriptions weren't just in his own name. He was using aliases
Oh, wow.
like F.E. Brooks, that was one of them,
Okay.
and Marilyn Pierce. And he told the doctor, oh, these are my research
Oh,
assistants.
so this is part of the whole scheme, the whole experiment.
Exactly. But the government's argument was, no, this is all a big lie.
Right.
He's not using these drugs for any legitimate scientific purpose. He's getting them to sell them. He's getting them to distribute them illegally.
So the aliases, that's a pretty big red flag right there.
Yeah.
Like if you're doing a legitimate scientific experiment,
Yeah.
why are you using a fake name?
Right. And that really speaks to this whole idea of intent, right?
Right.
Because, the question is, did he intend to distribute these illegally? Was that his plan?
Right.
Or was he genuinely, trying to do some plant research?
Right. And so the prosecution wants to use his past to prove his current intent. What did they dig up? What kind of evidence were they bringing in?
So They had two main things they were focusing on. One was what's called doctor shopping.
Okay.
And that's exactly what it sounds like.
Going around to lots of different doctors.
Going to multiple doctors in multiple states, trying to get prescriptions for controlled substances.
Oh, wow.
So they said, look, this is a pattern of behavior. This isn't just, you know, one-off. This guy repeatedly tries to get these drugs. And they're saying that suggests that he's not doing it for legitimate scientific reasons. He's doing it because he wants the drugs for himself.
So they're trying to paint a picture of him.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the second piece of evidence was a little bit, it was more specific to this case. It had to do with Marilyn Pierce, one of those aliases he used.
Okay.
What they did was they brought in evidence that someone named Marilyn Pierce, who was connected to this whole Effie Brooks alias, had actually been hospitalized for drug addiction.
Ooh, so now you're bringing in a whole other person.
Yeah, and this is where it gets really tricky, right?
Yeah.
Because now you're not just talking about Beasley, you're talking about someone else's struggles with drugs.
Right.
And that's where this whole issue of unfair prejudice becomes really, really important.
Right.
You know, is this just meant to make the jury think Beasley is a bad guy?
Right, right.
Or is it actually relevant to his intent to distribute Deloaded?
Yeah. So you've got Beasley saying, hey, these drugs, they're for research. I'm a scientist. This is legitimate.
Right.
Then you've got the prosecution saying, well, you've got this history of getting drugs. And look, one of your fake research assistants ended up in the hospital because of addiction.
Right.
It's a pretty big clash there.
It is. And that's at the heart of what makes this case so important for understanding these rules.
It is. Okay, so the case goes to trial. The jury hears all this.
Yeah.
What happens? What was the verdict?
The jury finds Beasley guilty on all 9 counts.
Wow.
He was sentenced to 7 years in prison for each count to be served concurrently.
Okay.
So all at the same time. He also had to pay a bunch of money.
Of course. And then what does he do?
Oh, he appeals, of course.
Of course he appeals.
Yeah.
So on appeal, what are his lawyers arguing? What are they saying went wrong at the trial?
His lawyers, their main argument was about that evidence we were just talking about.
Right.
The doctor shopping and the information about Marilyn Pierce's hospitalization. They're saying, look, this evidence should never have been allowed.
Okay.
It was prejudicial. It shouldn't have come in.
Right.
And it's the reason my client was convicted.
Okay. Now, this is where it gets a little interesting, I think, for our listeners. Because it wasn't like a complete win for Beasley on appeal.
Right. And that's why you have to be so careful about just reading like a summary of a case.
Right.
Because it might say, oh, yeah, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, they affirmed the lower court.
Right.
So you're thinking, okay, Beasley lost.
We lost, yeah.
But if you actually dig into the details like we did and look at something like the standard brief,
yeah,
you see a more complicated picture.
Right.
What happened was the Seventh Circuit, they vacated those convictions for intent to distribute Deloaded.
Oh, okay.
So those 7 counts,
yeah,
those got thrown out.
Okay.
But the 2 convictions for fraudulent procurement, those were upheld.
Oh, wow. So a partial win.
It's a split decision.
Interesting. So how did they come to that? How did they say, well, some of it was wrong, but some of it was right?
Well, what they basically said was, look, the trial court, they made some mistakes.
Okay.
They shouldn't have let in some of that evidence about Beasley's past.
Okay.
But, and this is really important, those errors were harmless when it came to the 2 fraud convictions.
Okay, now hold on. Break that down for me. What is harmless error mean?
So harmless error, and this is something all you future lawyers need to know, is this idea that even if there was a mistake made during the trial, like letting in the wrong evidence,
okay,
the appeals court won't automatically overturn the whole thing.
Okay.
If they look at everything and they say, well, yeah, there was a mistake, but there was still enough other evidence to justify the guilty verdict.
Got it.
And it doesn't seem like that error really changed the outcome.
Okay, so they're saying it was wrong, it didn't really matter in the end because there was so much other good evidence.
Right, especially for those fraud counts, which we'll talk about more in a bit.
Okay, so let's back up a little bit.
Okay.
We've been talking about this rule, 404B, which basically says you can't use someone's past bad acts to just say they're a bad person.
Right.
Right.
That's the general rule. You can't just smear someone's character.
Exactly. But there are exceptions.
Yeah.
When can you use that evidence?
So 404B lays out a bunch of very specific reasons.
Okay.
You can use it to prove things like motive, opportunity, intent, preparation, plan, knowledge, identity, or absence of mistake or accident.
Okay, that's a pretty long list.
It is, but it's specific. It's not just, oh, they're a bad person.
Right.
It has to be connected to something very specific in the case.
Right. So in Beasley's case, the prosecution saying, well, this past doctor shopping, that shows his intent.
Right. They're arguing, look, he's done this before, going to all these different doctors to get drugs.
Yeah.
So it makes it less likely that he was really trying to do plant research this time.
Right. It goes to his state of mind, his plan.
Exactly.
Okay. But did the appeals court buy that? Did they think that was a good enough reason to let that evidence in?
They did. They said, yeah, this doctor shopping, it does have some value in showing that there's this pattern.
Okay.
This pattern of behavior that's focused on getting these drugs.
Okay.
So it makes it less likely that this time it was for something innocent.
Right. Because he had a history of doing it for non-innocent reasons.
Right. Now, of course, they recognize there's a risk of prejudice.
Right. Like we've been saying.
The jury might just think, oh, he's done it before, so he must have done it again.
Right.
But they said, in this particular instance, the trial judge didn't go too far.
Okay, so that evidence was okay in their eyes.
For the limited purpose of showing intent.
Right.
But here's the thing you have to remember about this whole 404B thing. It's not enough to just show someone did something similar in the past. It has to be relevant to their state of mind or plan right now in the current case.
Right. Okay, so that's the doctor shopping. Now, what about that Marilyn Pierce evidence? What was the prosecution trying to do with that?
Well, with that, you know, they're really walking a fine line.
Yeah.
What they probably wanted the jury to think was, look, Beasley wasn't just getting drugs for himself. He was giving them to Marilyn Pierce. Maybe he even contributed to her addiction.
Right. So he's a dealer, not just a user.
Yeah.
Okay.
That would definitely suggest that he wasn't getting delauded for science.
Right.
He was getting it to distribute.
Right.
The problem is, and the appeals court pointed this out, the link between Beasley giving Pierce drugs and her hospitalization.
Yeah.
That was really weak.
Okay.
They didn't really prove that connection very well.
And the Seventh Circuit was not happy about that.
Oh, no. They said, look, this is highly prejudicial.
Right.
You're basically implying that this guy is responsible for someone else's addiction. That's a huge accusation. And it's not really directly tied to whether he intended to distribute these particular delauded prescriptions. The worry was that the jury's going to get all emotional, right? They're going to say, this guy's a terrible person. He hurts people with drugs.
Right.
And they're going to convict him based on that, not on the actual evidence about his intent with these prescriptions.
Right. But they still upheld the fraud convictions. So why was the Marilyn Pierce stuff considered harmless for those?
So for those two counts, remember, those were about how he got the prescriptions.
Yeah. With the fake names.
Right. And for that, the appeals court said, look, his intent to distribute doesn't really matter.
Right.
It doesn't matter what he was planning to do with the drugs after he got them. The fact that he used aliases, lied to the doctor, that's enough to prove fraud right there.
Right. Because the fraud was in the act of lying to get the prescription.
Exactly. It doesn't matter what he did with the drugs later.
Got it. So it's a different kind of intent.
Yeah.
It's the intent to deceive to get the drugs in the first place.
Right.
Okay. Now, one thing that caught my eye. One of the sources we looked at mentioned Judge Easterbrook, who was on the Seventh Circuit panel.
Right.
And he had some pretty strong words about how the trial court handled this whole balancing act.
Yeah.
You know, weighing the value of the evidence against how prejudicial it might be.
Oh, yeah. He was critical of the trial court.
Yeah.
Because it didn't really seem like the judge had really thought carefully about all of this evidence of Beasley's past.
Okay.
And Judge Easterbrook specifically called out this thing where the trial court seemed to let in certain evidence, like the fact that Beasley had given other people Valium and codeine back in 1981.
Okay.
And they just let it in because it showed a pattern of drug activity.
Okay.
And that was Judge Easterbrook's whole point. He said, look, just showing a general pattern, that's not enough.
Right.
It's not enough to justify letting in this kind of evidence. There has to be a much more direct link, a link to a specific reason that's allowed under 404B. Like, you know, was it relevant to his intent? Was it relevant to his knowledge, to his plan? You can't just say pattern and call it a day.
So like the Valium and codeine thing from way back when.
Yeah.
That's not really relevant to whether he was planning to distribute Dilaudid in 1980.
Exactly. And even all those details about Marilyn Pierce's addiction.
Yeah.
He said, look, that's way more prejudicial than it is helpful.
Right.
all you really needed to know was that she was connected to the alias.
Right. Just the basic fact.
Right. All those extra details, that was just trying to paint Beasley as a bad guy.
Right. Which is exactly what 404B is trying to prevent.
Exactly. You can't just say, oh, look at all the bad things he's done, so he must be guilty.
Right.
You have to connect it to a specific purpose.
Right. Okay. So we've gone through this whole case. We've talked about all these rules and arguments. For our listeners, especially those of you who are going to be lawyers someday, what are the key takeaways here? Yeah. What should you really be remembering from this?
So I think there are a few really big things.
Okay.
Number one, whenever the prosecution tries to bring in evidence of someone's past, you know, under 404B,
yeah,
you object.
Right.
You object, and you don't just say objection, you say objection. The prosecution needs to tell us exactly why they think this evidence is allowed. What specific purpose does it serve?
Right. And don't let them just get away with saying pattern.
No. Make them say, we think this is evidence of his intent, or this shows his plan, or this is about his knowledge, whatever it is. Make them be specific.
Okay, so be specific in your objections. What else?
Number two, if you end up arguing this on appeal, look closely at what the trial judge said. Did they actually do that balancing test that 403 talks about?
Right, where they weigh the value of the evidence against how prejudicial it is.
Exactly. Did they actually say on the record, okay, here's why I think this evidence is more helpful than it is harmful? If they didn't, that's a really good argument for you on appeal.
Okay, good tip. What else?
And then the last thing I'd say is really understand that concept of harmless error.
Right, the idea that just because a mistake was made doesn't mean the whole case gets thrown out.
Right. Because each time the appeals court says, yeah, the trial court messed up, they're going to look at everything. And if they say, well, there was still enough other evidence or that error didn't really change things, then the conviction might stand.
So you really have to think about, okay, even if there was an error,
yeah,
did it really affect the outcome?
Exactly.
Interesting. Now, one last thought.
Okay.
Beasley really shows how much power the trial judge has in these situations.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
They have a lot of discretion, right, to make these decisions about evidence.
Right, because they're the ones there in the courtroom.
Right.
They see how it all plays out.
So how should law students be thinking about that?
It's a balancing act. On the one hand, we want to give trial judges some leeway.
Right, we trust their judgment.
Yeah.
To some extent.
Yeah. We don't want appeals courts second-guessing every little decision.
Right.
But, and this is what Beasley shows, they can't just do whatever they want.
Right.
The appeals courts, they expect to see that the trial judge actually thought about these rules.
Right.
They considered the prejudice. They didn't just let in any evidence the prosecution wanted.
So that balancing test, that's really important.
It is. It's a key part of this whole thing.
Well, I think this has been a really great deep dive into this case.
Yeah, me too. It's a fascinating one.
It shows how complex these rules are, especially when you're talking about using someone's past to try and prove what they were thinking.
Absolutely. It's not as simple as it might seem.
No, not at all. And for anyone involved in the legal system, whether you're a lawyer, a judge, or even a defendant, understanding these nuances can make a huge difference.
Absolutely.
And on that note, here's a final thought for everyone to chew on. We talked about that evidence regarding Marilyn Pierce's hospitalization. If you were a defense attorney and the judge decided to let that evidence in, how would you handle it?
Oh, that's a good question.
Right. How would you try to minimize the damage? What would you say to the jury to make sure they don't jump to the wrong conclusions about your client?
Yeah, that's a real strategic challenge because you've got this evidence that could really sway the jury, but you can't just ignore it.
Right. You've got to address it head on.
Yeah, and find a way to frame it in a way that helps your client.
It's a really interesting thing to think about. So thanks for joining us for this deep dive.
It was a pleasure.
We'll be back soon with another look at a key legal case.